last lecture. So I'll begin by discussing, finishing our discussion of race summation. And then in the second part of lecture, we'll discuss the vacuums of non-abelian gauge theories. So recall the question we were asking at the end of yesterday's lecture is if there's some exact quantity we're interested in, usually we can only compute it using perturbation theory, and we'll get some formal series in our small coupling that will in general be asymptotic to the quantity we're interested in, and usually this asymptotic series diverges. So we can go get the asymptotic series using perturbation theory, and what we're going to be interested in today is, can we ever go backwards? And the answer is at least sometimes we can. Seeing resummation procedures that, and often to do that, we need, or at least sometimes to do that, we need also information from the non-perturbative sector, the instanton. In particular, we need the instanton contributions to the quantity we're interested in. Okay. So typically, in both quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, when we get a perturbative series, the coefficients will grow factorially for large n. You can certainly construct counterexamples, but this is the most common case. You can show this for many of the examples we've looked at in quantum field theory, and this and in quantum mechanics. And so if we've got a series like this, it will generally be a divergent series. And so what perturbation theory is going to give us is a series that's asymptotic to F. So if we want to know the value of F for some finite value of G, the simplest thing we can do is try to find the best approximation we can get using a finite number of terms in the asymptotic series. And if we plot the error versus n, what will typically happen is that is at the beginning, we take more and more terms, we get a better and better approximation. But eventually, since the series diverges, it gets worse and worse. So there'll be some n star that provides the optimal truncation. And well, if we know that the coefficients in the series behave like this for large n, we can estimate what the optimal truncation will be. So, and it's also typical that a n star g to the n star is the smallest term. So we'll assume that. Um, So assuming this asymptotic behavior for the coefficients and that the optimal truncation means keeping terms up to the smallest term in the series, we can figure out what's the best we can do and figure out what f of g is if we know the asymptotic series. So what we want to do is minimize a n g to the n for fixed g. And if n is large, then we know what our coefficients look like. There'll be some constant times n factorial times g over a to the n. And using the Stirling approximation, we can write this as c times the exponential of n log n minus 1 minus log a over g. Just put this in the exponential. And this is minimized at n star is approximately a over g, again, assuming n is large. And so the error will typically be of the same size as the next term. Give me a minute. And in this case, that's e to the minus a over g. So this is a non-perturbative function. So if we have an asymptotic series like this, there's a non-perturbative ambiguity. So this is another connection we see between non-perturbative physics and perturbative physics. So yesterday I argued that the divergences of perturbative series is connected to non-perturbative physics by Dyson's argument. Here we see another connection. Okay. So if we're doing perturbation series, we can never, with this set of assumptions, we can never do better than this. There'll always be some non-perturbative ambiguity. So what we're going to ask is, can we ever do better? So we might need some more information, some information from the non-perturbative sector. But if we include that additional information, can we go backwards from the asymptotic series to the original function that we were trying to approximate? And one way to do this is, there's a very particular type of resummation procedure that has some nice properties, and that is the Borel resummation procedure. So first let me explain what it is, and then I'll explain how it can be useful in going backwards from the asymptotic series to the exact function. So Borel resummation is a two-step procedure. And the first thing we need to do if we want to compute the Borel resummation is find the Borel transform. So the Borel transform denote as phi hat of zeta. And it's defined to be the sum from n equals 0 to infinity of a n over n factorial times zeta of n. So that's just like the original series, but we throw in an extra factor of n factorial, which will make often make the Borel transform have a finite radius of convergence, even if the original series up here has zero radius of convergence. So this improves convergence. Well, Borel transforms often have a finite radius of convergence, but we can often define a Borel transform on the entire complex plane by analytic continuation. And let's see an example of how that works. So a simple example is if our series is minus 1 to the n, n factorial z to the n, that's of the same type we were considering before. With this is an equality and a equal to minus 1. Then the Borel transform is just the same series without the n factorial. And so this series can be summed. This has a radius of convergence 1. And the sum of this series is just 1 over 1 plus, this is a zeta, 1 plus zeta. So this works for zeta less than 1. But it's very clear how to analytically continue this function to the whole complex plane, except for the isolated pole at z equals minus 1. So we can then analytically continue. Okay. So that's step one in defining the Borel sum. Step two is to perform a Laplace transform. So the Borel resummation procedure is we take so we want to compute the Borel sum of a series that's defined to be the Laplace transform of the Borel transform. And the reason that this particular resummation procedure is interesting is that it's constructed in such a way that if we compute the asymptotic series of the Borel sum, it will match, assuming everything exists. The Borel transform doesn't always exist, and even if it does, the Borel sum doesn't always exist. But assuming everything exists, we'd compute the asymptotic series of this Borel sum for z goes to 0. We can do that just by plugging in the definition of the Borel transform, then swapping the sum and the integral. What we'll get is n equals 0, the sum of an over n factorial gamma n plus 1, zn, and these cancel. So we just get phi z. So the gamma just comes from, here we'll have an integral of e to the minus zeta. This will have a zeta to the n, so we'll get a gamma. Okay. So, if everything exists, the asymptotic series of the sum matches the original asymptotic series we started with. And for our example. So for this example, this function has no singularities on the real axis, so we can compute the Borel sum with no problems. But on the other hand, if we started with a sum that we just changed the sign here, and our original sum was n factorial z to the n, then we'll just change the sign here and here, and the Borel transform will be 1 over 1 minus zeta, which has a pole on the real axis, so it's clear that the Borel sum is not defined. And in general, there'll be a singularity on the real axis if the terms are all the same sign and the asymptotic growth in the coefficients is the same one we assumed, and that's very common in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory problems. So the case with singularities is the more common case, the case we're mostly interested in. And, well, there's a solution. You can still define the sum of a series even if the Borel transform has a singularity on the real axis, and that's to deform the contour. So the complex plane we're generally interested in doing is trying to do a Borel transform, but a Borel sum, but the Borel transform often has singularities on the real axis. And well, it's easy to define a contour that avoids these, but there's, well, two simple ways to do that. One is we could define a contour C plus that goes above all the singularities. Alternatively, we could define a contour C minus that goes below the singularities. And so the lateral Borel resummation is defined to be the Borel resum, summation with, instead of along the real axis, along one of these slightly deformed contours. And, well, even if everything is real, because all our coefficients are real, f, the function we're trying to approximate is real, the Borel transform is real, these lateral Borel resummations will have an imaginary part. So we're deforming the contour into the complex plane. So if the an are real, the lateral Borel resummations will have an imaginary part, and the difference between S plus and S minus will be purely imaginary. And, well, if the singularities are just simple poles, let's assume there's a single singularity, it's a simple pole, at zeta equals A, then S plus minus S minus, you can compute it explicitly, and it will be 2 pi I e to the minus A over Z, A over Z, where A, small a, is the residue. And so again, we see this non-perturbative function. So there's an ambiguity in the imaginary part of most of the cases of interest that is connected with the non-perturbative physics. And, well, so how do we resolve this? So we've already computed the decay rates, and we saw that it was proportional to 1 over the square root of the determinant with the zero modes removed of S double prime times e to the minus A over G. And S, this determinant was of a Hessian that had a single negative mode. So here we see, well, there's a choice of sign. We're taking the square root of a negative number. This is a ambiguity in the contribution of the instantons. And this is connected to the back to the Borel sum for the ground state energy has an ambiguity depending on the choice of contour over there. So this ambiguity is not so important to resolve because, well, we were just looking at the imaginary, we're looking at the decay rate, we're just looking at the imaginary part of the energy, the absolute value, so it's not essential to resolve this. But it's also true that we look at the ground state energy of the double well potential. This is real, and the corresponding perturbative series is not Borel summable. So here, there's an ambiguity in the imaginary part, but we know the imaginary part should be zero. And, well, so this ambiguity in the imaginary part comes from continuing the sum into the complex plane. And you can show that this ambiguity will exactly cancel against an ambiguity in the contributions of the instantons if we do an analytic continuation. This cancels with ambiguity in the imaginary part of analytically continued instantons. And so by including the instantons, we can avoid this ambiguity and, in principle at least, recover the exact function for the ground state energy of the double well as a function of, say, the quartic term. So the sketch of how these ideas work, due to time constraints, I can't fill in all the details, but Yeah, so instantons plus resummation of perturbative series can, at least in, under some circumstances, recover exact functions that we're interested in. And any questions on this material before I move on to the vacuum of non-abelian gauge theory?
Okay. Where does the ambiguity in the imaginary part of the discontinued instanton come from? Like, compared to what we did before in the instanton?
So what we'll need to do is continue. In order to make this cancellation work, we'll need to continue g from positive to negative values. And so there, if we're doing a rotation in the complex plane, there's two ways to rotate a positive g to a negative g. And there'll be some ambiguity across the one, either the positive or negative axis. Okay. So for the remainder of lecture, we're going to change gears rather dramatically, while still discussing instantons. But the question we're going to ask is, what is the ground state of a non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions? And throughout lecture, we'll be working in the Euclidean space. And for a pure gauge theory, so our action will look like this. And I'll use all the same conventions for Euclidean space time as I did last week. So our interest is in what are the ground states. What's the ground state of this theory in four dimensions? And, well, instantons are going to play a role. What we're going to find is that there are a infinite, approximately degenerate set of ground states, just like the periodic potential. But instanton effects will break that degeneracy. And so if we're interested in both finding the ground state and the instantons, what we're going to be interested in are the finite action configurations of this gauge field. And so if we want to look for finite action configurations, that tells us that f mu nu should go to zero faster than 1 over r squared. As r goes to infinity, so that this integral in hyperspherical coordinates will be finite. And so assuming that, so if f goes like a power of r, then f should be order 1 over r cubed as r goes to infinity for this to exist. So that tells us that the gauge field configurations, so f involves derivatives of the gauge field. So A should be order 1 over r squared as r goes to infinity. Am I missing anything here? Does this necessarily follow from that? What about gauge transformations?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Because F mu nu is going to be the same, right?
F mu nu will be the same, but the gauge field configurations will be different. So if we want to look for the gauge field configurations, give us finite action, we should include a pure gauge term, gauge. We should look at not only gauge field configurations that go to zero, like one over R squared, but also gauge transformations of those configurations. Is that for all the... If we do a gauge transformation, we're not changing the physics. So all gauge equivalent gauge field configurations should give us the same physics. And we'll make another assumption. So we'll assume here that U for large R is independent of R, so it has a well-defined limit. As R goes to infinity. In other words, the limit as R goes to infinity of u of x is only a function of the angles. And, well, this can be justified by if we want the charges the conserved charges in this theory to be conserved, we can use Gauss's law to usually rewrite the charge as an integral of the conserved current over all of spacetime. Use Gauss's law to write that as an integral over the boundary. And if we want the charges to be well-defined, then we need this condition. If we want Gauss's law to work and the charges to be well-defined, then we need U to be a function only of the angles as R goes to infinity. So gauge field configuration of the finite action should look like this. We'll also be interested in when we're looking at the vacuum, so the vacuum should be described by the lowest energy state should be the states with A equals zero or gauge transformations. So in that case, we'll just ignore this term. So what we see here is that finite action is associated with some U on the boundary. It's a function only of the angles. Now, clearly, U is not unique. Because we can do a gauge transformation. And if we do a gauge transformation H, A goes to H A mu H inverse plus I H D H inverse, which we can rewrite as I H U. It's the derivative of U inverse H inverse. Just using the product rule, we get all the terms over there. Plus R to one over R squared terms. This will be unaffected by this. Now, if we could set HU to be the identity on the boundary of space-time at R goes to infinity, then we could always get rid of this term and ignore it, and it wouldn't be important. But that's not always possible to do.
What is this equality?
This equality is just assuming A takes this form.
H.
We're assuming it's of this form. H here is we're just doing a gauge transformation of this equation. Okay, so if HU, if we can set HU to be the identity at R equals infinity, then we could remove this term. However, if we do a gauge transformation, H should be continuous, not just on the boundary of spacetime, but over the entire spacetime. And turns out that requiring continuity over all of spacetime means that this is not possible in general. And to illustrate this point in a simpler context, I'll discuss this point in some detail for abelian gauge theory in two dimensions. Most of the arguments work very similarly in four dimensions, but are slightly more complicated. So I'll briefly discuss the changes after we go through the abelian case in two dimensions. And the fact that this is not possible in general is going to lead us to the conclusion that there are different classes of, say, pure gauge, of gauge field configurations that are pure gauge on the boundary of spacetime that are not continuously deformable into one another. And so those different classes, will have a correspondence to the different possible ground states. That I'll elaborate on that point once we see what these classes are. Okay, so the simplest case where we can see why this works is U1 theory in D equals 2. And as I mentioned before, everything today is Euclidean. So same arguments tell us if we want finite action, then F should be order 1 over R squared, and A should be 1 over R squared plus a pure gauge term. And so if U is only a function of the angles on the boundary, then U of x is just a function of theta, the periodic, we're assuming we're working in polar coordinates here. Write this as U of theta.
Should theta be of order
1 over R? 1 over R, yes, thank you. Okay, so U here is a map from the circle, the spatial circle at infinity, the over the angular direction, to the circle. We can think of U1 as a circle. An element of U1 is just a complex number of unit norm. So it describes a point on the unit circle. So U1 here is a map from the circle at infinity in D equal to Euclidean space to the circle U1. And maps of this type are not continuously deformable into one another and can instead be classified by their winding number, by how many times the maps wind around the circle. So there are a set of standard mappings that illustrate this idea. So the first map we can consider is a trivial map, which I'll call U0 of theta. It just maps all points on the boundary of our Euclidean space to the identity in our group. There's also the identity mapping, which maps every point to on the boundary to the corresponding point on the unit circle. And there are also maps that wind new times. So as for this map, as theta goes from 0 to 2 pi over nu, which is 1 over nu part of the circle at infinity, it's mapped to all points on the circle in the group U1. And so if we go over the full range of theta, we map to all of the points on in U1 new times. So it basically, this map winds around U1 new times. And it can be shown, and I'll motivate this, some aspects of this theorem in a minute, that any map from the circle to the circle is continuously deformable to exactly one of these maps. And another word for continuously deformable is homotopic too. So to see that, we can recover nu from a map by this formula. So if we integrate over u times the derivative of u inverse, then what we get, so this works in general. We can see that it gives us the right answer by plugging in these representatives. We get I over 2 pi, integral 2 pi, d theta, e to the I nu theta. The derivative brings down a factor of minus I nu, and then e to the minus I nu theta. And so this cancels, and we're left with the integral gives us 2 pi, I cancels the minus I, and so we get nu. So it works at least for that case. And furthermore, we can show that if we do a continuous deformation of u, the winding number will be unchanged. So that tells us that the winding number, we can classify the homotopy classes of these maps, can be labeled by the winding number. Yes.
You said there that I think you use full of aspirin 1 over r squared.
Yes.
Why isn't it r cubed in four dimensions?
F?
Why should full of aspirin 1 over r cubed?
So if f goes like 1 over r squared, let's just say f goes like 1 over r squared, then we have go to hyperspherical coordinates, we have r cubed dr over r to the fourth, which diverges.
So in that case, would it be enough to just have 1 over r?
1 over r, then we'd have, here we're in two dimensions, so we'd have r dr over r squared, which again would diverge logarithmically.
Why would 1 over r?
dr over r. So 1 over r squared will be enough for it to be finite. So in this case, if f is like 1 over r, then s will be like the integral r dr over r squared. It's like dr over r, which is log r, for large r,
no.
The integral.
Is this the only mapping we are allowed to consider?
These are not the only mappings we're allowed to consider, but these are representatives of all of the possible classes. Any other map can be continuously deformed to one of these maps. So these are representatives of all of the homotopy classes. So if we have any other map, by doing a gauge transformation that's continuous in all of space-time, we can bring that other map into one of these forms. Okay. So, well, to see that its winding number is invariant, we do a continuous deformation, we can just see how the integrand changes. We do a continuous deformation, and the integrand goes like this. Got two terms. If we just work to linear order in delta u, assuming this is a small continuous deformation, we get a delta u times the derivative u inverse. We also get a u times the derivative of the variation in u inverse. We can write as u inverse times the variation times u inverse. And, well, we can expand out these terms. If we use the product rule here, we get three terms. First is u dv theta u inverse. The next term is the u and the u inverse will cancel, so we're just left with a dd theta of delta u times u inverse. And the last term, where dd theta acts on the u inverse, will cancel with our first term because the u and the u inverse will cancel. And so since this is an abelian group, everything commutes here, which makes this easier. And we can rewrite these two terms as a total derivative. So get this. Total derivative of u inverse delta u, which is a total derivative and will vanish after we integrate it in this formula. Okay. So we've seen that the mappings that are functions of the angle fall into angle only. So we're assuming that this pure gauge term has a well-defined limit as r goes to infinity. So with that assumption, the gauge field configurations that are pure gauge at infinity fall into classes that are labeled by the winding number. And they're not continuously deformable if we want to remain in this same class. So if we assume that the pure gauge field configurations have zero energy, which is fairly reasonable, then what we've shown here is that the ground state of this theory is degenerate. So there are a infinite set of approximately degenerate vacua labeled by nu. And there's going to be an energy barrier. We expect there to be an energy barrier between these different states, because if we want to go from a gauge field configuration that's pure gauge with one winding number to a gauge field configuration that's pure gauge with a different winding number, well, there will be some trajectories in configuration space that will do that, but they're not. We can't do that by remaining in the class of gauge field configurations that are pure gauge. So we're going to have to go to other gauge field configurations that are not pure gauge to expect to have higher energy. So there should be a barrier between these degenerate vacua. And I say approximately here because we've seen that if we have degenerate vacua, instant effects can lift the degeneracy. So it's approximately is because of instantons. And there's one more useful property in two dimensions before we return to four dimensions, the case of interest. And that's there's another way we can write the winding number. So we can write this as u, this is the definition, and the integrand is almost a theta. So at infinity. So we can write this in another way as the integral r goes to infinity of r a theta. And we can also write this as d theta r times r hat epsilon mu nu a nu Where here, our hat is just a unit vector in the radial direction. So that picks out the theta component here of A. So if we had any component in the r direction, it would vanish by the antisymmetry of the of epsilon. So we can write this as an integral using Gauss's theorem instead of a boundary integral as a integral over all of spacetime. And this write it in this way, the integrand is just the chiral anomaly from last week. So there's a connection here between the winding number, and as we'll see, the instantons, and the anomaly. Okay, so things work fairly similarly in four dimensions. Basically, most of the properties I've stated and derived in two dimensions for abelian gauge theory work in essentially the same way. For non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions. So in 4D, it's a very similar story. For non-abelian gauge theories, and but not for abelian gauge theories. And that's because every map from the sphere, the boundary of four-dimensional spacetime, to the circle, which is U1, can be trivially mapped to the identity map. So there's no classes like there were in 2D for abelian gauge theory in 4D. But there is a winding number for any non-abelian gauge, simple non-abelian gauge theory in.
Could you explain this statement, please? Could you explain again this statement, please?
This statement? So the statement is that we can classify the gauge field configurations that are pure gauge on the boundary of four-dimensional Euclidean space by their winding number. So for SU2, SU2 is basically the three-sphere. So what we're looking at is the classification of maps from the three-sphere to the three-sphere. Those can also be classified by a winding number, which is defined very similarly to how we define the winding number over here. So the story, the formula for the winding number is slightly different, but in spirit, the story is essentially the same in four dimensions.
But is it still homotopy or is it?
It's still homotopy classes.
But for SU2, homotopy is not trivial. We are working in SU2, homotopy is not supposed to be trivial. Hence, if we are doing SU2 gauge theories, then you have zero homotopy. Whatever you do.
We're looking at maps from the boundary of spacetime to SU2, and there are non-trivial homotopy classes for that matter. And for other simple gauge groups, there's a theorem that shows that any mapping from S3 to that gauge group can be deformed into a map from S3 to an SU2 subgroup. Mm-hmm. So it works essentially the same way for any non-abelian.
And why not for abelian gauge theory?
Not for abelian gauge theory because the homotopy classes of this mapping are trivial.
It's trivial?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, what does this tell us? So this tells us that there are discrete set of vacuum states labeled by an integer, the winding number. And so this is very similar to the periodic potential that we looked at yesterday. We have a infinite set of approximately degenerate ground states that are labeled by an integer. And as we saw yesterday, the degeneracy will be lifted by instanton effects. So in the periodic potential, we saw we had an instanton that took us from one vacuum to the neighboring vacuum. The same thing is works here. And what you'll show in your homework is there that there is an instanton with finite action S1, which is 8 pi over g squared, that changes the winding number by 1. So this instanton will take us from one vacuum to the neighboring vacuum. And in general, if we wanted to compute the amplitude to go from one vacuum to a different vacuum, that would be given by a functional integral over the gauge field configurations that have winding number equal to the difference between n and m times e to the Euclidean action. And so if we study this integral in the semi-classical limit, like we did before, we find that we can compute this amplitude by summing over all the instanton and anti-instanton contributions where there are new more instantons than anti-instantons. So that would work basically the same way that we saw yesterday when we were looking at the periodic potential. Okay, so like the periodic potential, these states are not the energy eigenstates, states that were localized in one particular vacuum. In the periodic potential, were not the energy eigenstates. To look at linear combinations, we explicitly constructed that for the double potential where we had just two. But let's see if we can figure out what the vacuum states look like here. So state n is not an energy eigenstate, so it's going to have a finite overlap with the state n prime, and that is controlled by instanton effects. So we need n minus n prime instantons to get from n to n prime. So that should look something like that. And the energy eigenstates are going to be combinations of all of the states n. So these are the energy eigenstates. So n are not energy eigenstates. The theta states are. And to see this, we can compute n prime h theta, which is the sum using the definition of theta and using this first property, this is e to the minus I n theta e to the minus n prime s1. If we make a shift, here we're summing over n, in our integration or summation variable from n to m plus n prime, this becomes sum over m e to the minus I m plus n prime e to the minus m s1. And this gives us e to the minus I n theta prime, which is just n prime theta. Sorry. So done here in the first line is just used definition, shifted our summation variable. We pull out a factor of e to the I n theta. What's left over is a constant. And we can identify this constant as e theta, because this works for any n prime. So the only way that would be possible is if this constant is the energy eigenvalue of theta. So these are the energy eigenstates. These are the true vacua of the theory. And we can try to compute the amplitude for one vacuum to evolve into another one. And that's going to be, using the definitions, the sum n minus ht m e to the minus I n theta minus m theta prime. We change our summation variable from m to nu, which is n minus m. This gives us sum over n e to the I n theta prime minus theta, sum over nu n minus ht e to the I nu theta. So this here is just a representation of the Dirac delta. So from this computation, we learn that these two vacuum states are independent. They have no overlap. One will never evolve into another. And we can rewrite this other part in terms of a path integral. So this part here, just the integral over the gauge field configurations with winding number nu, e to the minus se, And similarly, to in two dimensions, the winding number in four dimensions can be written in terms of an integral of the anomaly. So this term here is e to the plus I theta. Write it on another line. This term here is related to the anomaly. And so what we get, we put everything together. So here, we're doing a path integral restricted to gauge field configurations with specific winding number. We're also summing over them. So that's the same as integrating over all gauge field configurations. And the anomaly term then gives us a new term in our path integral. So the correct path integral that describes this process involves a new term. And this new term, well, it's related to which theta vacuum we choose. But the parameter theta is a new parameter of our theory that we've seen by our consideration of the vacuum structure of the theory. And this term is interesting because it violates parity and CP. Alone in a pure gauge theory, it's not observable. But if we couple the theory to fermions, well, we've seen we can get a term like this. If we have chiral fermions and we do a chiral rotation, we get an anomaly. That's not a symmetry of the quantum theory. And so if we have a theory with massive fermions, it turns out you need in order to get an observable effect, then the choice of theta together with the chiral anomaly coming from the fermion sector, some combination of those parameters is observable and can lead to interesting effects, violates C, P, and CP. And so QCD is a theory with massive fermions. It's a non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions. And so in principle, there's some observable parameter that's related to this theta, that is our choice of vacuum. But so far, it hasn't been observed. And there's fairly strong bounds on the size of it. It has to be less than about 10 to the minus 10, which is a puzzle. Okay. So today, first part, we discussed briefly some ideas about how we can incorporate instanton effects together with divergent series in order to recover exact quantities we're interested in. We also discussed the structure of the vacuum, non-abelian gauge theory. The missing piece is what are the instantons, what do they look like, and you'll construct those explicitly in your homework. And we saw that choice of vacuum here, well, I briefly argued that the choice of vacuum here, together with our discussion from last week about the chiral anomaly, can lead to interesting physics, interesting and observable physics, namely violation of parity and CP. Any questions? Thank you for your attention.